Okay. Welcome, everyone, to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are one of many international ULTs that spread broadcast these ideas of universal brotherhood that was put forth by H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge back in 1875. And we put forth these ideas in a form of a declaration that you will hear in the same declaration in every ULT around the world. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists wherever and however situated is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. And in order to fulfill these lofty goals, the lodge here in Philadelphia has two meetings a week, as we're here on Sunday. We have talks and discussions. Today we're having a panel discussion. Sometimes we have shorter talks or called forums or lectures. But there's always time after the presentation to have ample time for questions and discussion. Now that we're starting December, the overall umbrella topic is cycles and cyclic law. Today we'll be looking at the idea of cyclic influences and opportunities. Next week we'll be looking at the world of dreams. The doors open on Sundays at 10:30. The meeting runs from 11 until 12. On Wednesdays, we are studying The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. The doors open at 5:15, and we have a reference library that is open until 7:15, and then the class starts at 7:30 and runs until 8:30. If you have any personal studies you wish to endeavor, there's always a student available to assist you in finding the appropriate reading material. And the reading for that night for the class will be available, as well as an accompanying reference to help explain the ideas a little more clearly. The book table is open before and after all of our meetings, and it's straight line theosophical printings, and we just pay for shipping and printing. We don't make any kind of profit off of it. We are financially sustained entirely by voluntary contributions. Its activities depend similarly on voluntary offerings in time and work. All are invited to participate, but no obligation is imposed or implied. So again, the class for today will be looking at these ideas of cyclic influences and opportunities. And we'll just read something from Mr. Judge's Ocean of Theosophy on this idea of cycles so that we can all understand what the class will be about when we're talking about cycles. So this is from Mr. Judge's Ocean of Theosophy. It's his chapter on cycles. The doctrine of cycles is one of the most important in the whole theosophical system, though the least known, and of all the one most infrequently referred to. Western investigators have, for some centuries, suspected that events move in cycles, and a few of the writers in the field of European literature have dealt with the subject, but all in a very incomplete fashion. This incompleteness and want of accurate knowledge have been due to the lack of belief in spiritual things and the desire to square everything with materialistic science. Nor do I pretend to give the cyclic law in full, for it is one that is not given out in detail by the masters of wisdom. But enough has been divulged, and enough was for a long time known to the ancients to add considerably to our knowledge. Then he goes on to explain exactly what a cycle is. It is a ring or turning, as the derivation of the word indicates. The beginning of a cycle must be a moment that, added to other moments, makes a day, and those added together constitute months, years, decades, and centuries. Beyond this, the West hardly goes.
So, cycles are very mysterious, and yet at the same time, they're very obvious. We see now the cycle of fall turning into winter, kind of an end rolling. We have, like, just like the cycles of the season, the cycles of man. We have youth. Well, we have infancy, youth, middle age, and then old age. And in India, they have four periods where they have the student, the householder, the contemplator, and the active altruist. So these cycles are well established, and we can see them operating everywhere, especially this time of year with the changing of the colors of the trees and the leaves coming off and winter coming in. And there is like an end drawing. And we think that, you know, it's a good, all year long is a good time for contemplation, but especially this time of year to contemplate and to reassess the year, and also to make resolutions for the coming year. That will be spoken about towards the end of the month, so we don't want to go in that direction. But it's something to always, you know, consider how we can add how can we impress ourselves through the psychic impulses in order to go forth and spread broadcast the teachings to the best of our ability. In theosophy, you know, we had the cycle of in 1875, we had there's a 100 year cycle, and this is a strong influence where since 1375, when Tsongkhapa, who was the great reformer of Buddhism, because it had really degenerated. So from time to time, there are these great beings that come to set us back on track. So Tsongkhapa initiated a cycle, a new spiritual cycle, a reformation, which started in the East, but it goes to the West and then back to the East. And we see this back and forth, this constant exchange. And so there's the 100-year cycle, and there's a 250-year cycle where things go from east to west and back again. And there was a time when the psychic, when we were not all on the same page, as it were. We were not all experiencing the same cycles at the same time. And we can look back in history and we can see Persia, which was had great learning, a scientific and philosophical and material and mathematical advancements when Europe was in the Dark Ages. And we look at India, which never lost the great teachings and the belief in masters, and actually the masters walked among the people and taught. But in Europe, there was great ignorance. At the same time, we should mention that the Native Americans, they had a very highly advanced philosophically. They were very highly, may not so much materially, but they weren't really into the materialistic aspects. They provided for all their needs, and they were, it's really, there's a great book called Black Elk Speaks, which really is, explains very well the theosophical teachings of the Native Americans. So we're influenced, we're not just influenced by, there's the 100-year cycle, there's that 250-year cycle, there's a messianic cycle, which we really couldn't find much on, but it said it's a 2155-year cycle of where, in a sense, a Messiah comes. And it's not to save ourselves, like the Christian Messiah that is spoken of, that we will just be absolved of all our sins and live happily ever after. But there's like these great beings that come from time to time to reset things. When things get too, when they degenerate, I just can't think of a better word than that. When things just kind of degenerate and we lose our bearings due to the overwhelming materialism. So in 1875, this cycle became, it came to a point where these teachings, which had been only kept by a few, by secret societies and individuals, because of the threat of death, really, of being burned at the stake or executed or tortured for going against the authority of the church, which was keeping the people illiterate and in ignorance. So by the time 1875 came around, and in this New York City, and the modern theosophical movement came about, and it was, in a sense, a resurrection of all the old teachings, like the Platonic teachings and the Gnostics, the Vedas, the Indian, and theosophy is not, you know, it is not esoteric Buddhism, it's not Gnosticism, it's not a religion, but it is really religion itself. And so it goes back to the very heart, the very root of everything. And, you know, it's no cult or sect, and it's something that belongs to each and all. And in the beginning of the world, there's in the beginning of the 18 million years ago, there came the midpoint of our evolutionary cycle, which was the beginning of a new cycle. And these great kings, king initiates, hierophants, and they taught us and impressed on infant humanity all of the arts and the sciences and philosophy that was necessary. And then we had a golden age. There's four ages. There's the golden, the silver, the bronze, and the iron or black age or dark age, which is this Kali Yuga. And Kali Yuga means black. Kali means black in Sanskrit, and Yuga means age. So we have here, we had a great, in a sense, loss of knowledge, a straying away from the teachings. But theosophy came upon the scene at such a time that these teachings were ripe. The soil had been prepared, and it had been prepared through the Declaration of Independence and our Constitution and our freedom of speech, religion, assembly. That it couldn't have occurred really much before when it did. So the soil had been tilled, and it was ripe. The time was right, and for the fruits of these teachings to be tasted, as it were. And the seed had been germinating for hundreds of years, but the time had come. So in Kali Yuga, it's an age, there's many horrors, it's the shortest age, and it's the most difficult age, but it's also the age where we can progress much more rapidly than other ages. So any effort that's made in this age can go four times, the results can be seen four times as rapidly as they can in other ages. So there's many, many articles on cycles. There's one pamphlet specifically just deals all with Mr. Judge's writings on cycles, cyclic impression and return in our evolution, Kali Yuga, and signs of the cycle. It's the thing about cycles, it's very mysterious, because if one really understood and knew cycles, one would really understand karma, which is, cycles is part of the second fundamental, which is reincarnation and karma. It's law. So if one could understand the cycles, one would understand the law. But except for the masters of wisdom who have mastered all the knowledge, there's only a partial understanding at this point. And apparently that's because if one really had all this esoteric knowledge, but would use it selfishly, that there would be great harm. So fascinating subject, very deep. That messianic cycle we mentioned pretty much coincides with the zodiac, the 12 signs of the zodiac. And then we have the cycle of the Earth's rotation. We have this 365-year cycle. And then we have the grand cycle of 8,600 years or so, where or long than that, we forget. But there's the cycle of the sun going around the zodiac as well.
So we've just heard a grander idea of cycles, how it affects all the history, how it affects cosmic life. So we're going to bring it down to a more specific opportunity here to determine how cycles affect humans, and how can we use these opportunities, and are there opportunities that are presented to us by understanding these ideas of cycles? And the whole idea for this part of the talk is to determine how can we learn to use the cycles, and not just for us, but for to put forth the idea of universal brotherhood. So as was stated in the first talk, the fundamental propositions, deity, law, and evolution, when we're looking at the second fundamental, that of law, when we delve into the second fundamental, that exactly is what we're studying today, is the idea of cycles. And also when we're looking at the idea of cycles and how it affects the cosmos, great nature, all of that, humans then, we can make our cycles by this idea of karma and reincarnation, and we'll get into that in a minute. And we know the idea of the physical cycles of sleep, wakefulness, sunrise, and sunset. And when one asks somebody about, well, what do you know about cycles? This is what you're going to hear. You're going to hear about the seasons, the day, you know, waking up, going to sleep, that sort of thing. But nobody ever knows about how can they be used as an opportunity. We're going to talk a little bit about this idea of cyclic return of impressions, because in effect, this is what karma is. The actions that we perform, or the thoughts that we are thinking in one life, will return to us in a future life. And the whole idea then is, what are we going to do when they return, and how are we going to know if those impressions are returning? Well, we're not going to really know if a situation comes to us and it's like, oh, this is a cyclic return of impressions. No, we're not going to know. What it is we have to do our duty. Whatever comes to us in any kind of an experience, thoughts, whatever, it is from our karmic actions in the past. And these are cyclic return of impressions. And we have impressed in past lives, whatever we think, however we act, however we choose, these are being impressed on our nature and will be coming forward in a future life. So we don't need to know the specifics of what we did in a past life to bring these impressions forward. We just need to know that whatever comes to us is ours and is our duty to deal with. And there was an interesting quote, and we would reiterate what was said about that pamphlet on cycles. If anybody wants to do a deeper study, there's some fascinating information. And we found in it as well, Mr. Judge And he's talking about if you do something once, you have a tendency to repeat it. And he says, you do it twice and it doubles its influence, a greater tendency to do that same thing again. So this is what happens with the impressions from life to life. So if we think something bad, or even if we think of something good, and if something happens and we realize that it may not be the most positive thing for us to do, if we don't change it, then it is impressed on our nature again, and then it'll come back. And sometimes if it happens in the same life, it's those kinds of situations where people say, why does this keep happening to me? And so those kinds of things we have to look at, but Theosophy gives us the tools to realize that we can affect changes for the next life to come. We have that choice. We have that chance. And like habits, we usually end up talking about resolutions and habits at the end of the year in classes, but we'll just mention that a habit can be changed. It's another one of those impressions coming forward. And again, we have to be aware that we can change these things. Having a spiritual life isn't going to make our lives, we're losing our train of thought, but we can change those habits. They are not locked in stone, and we can change them. And even if it is a good impression, it still has to be acknowledged. It still has to be dealt with. And there has to be that motive behind that good impression as to how we're going to use it to benefit others. So we impress ourselves with all the things that we've done. And when the time is right for these impressions to come forward, karma is not linear. It's not what I do today will affect the next life. We could be dealing with lessons we have to learn from, 10, 20, 100 lifetimes ago. So the impressions show themselves, and we are given the opportunity whether to change it or not. And by having these ideas, by knowing the spiritual outcomes of the choices that we make, and that's the whole thing with cycles. Mr. Judge uses the horseshoe curve out in Johnstown. He uses that example that even though it's going in this direction, it is going up. And that's how our life and lives should be, that when we make these choices, that they're positive ones, and that even though we will come back maybe with other lessons to learn, if we have solved some of them now, we have this opportunity to do it. So the whole thing is practically about why do we need to know about the cyclic opportunities? And knowing, as we said, that these impressions will come back, we're not going to know the specifics, but we will feel them. And we do have the opportunity to change. And as was said in the first talk about the Kali Yuga, we have this huge opportunity, even though life seems to be very materialistic now. Spiritually, it may be on a low ebb, but it is also said that any progress we make here is like is pushed forward, and that we will be making more progress by changing and doing good than if it was in one of the other cycles. And he said, Mr. Judge says, in the other ages, the rates of all things are slower than in this. Hence, evil now seems quick, but in the same way, good is also much quicker in effect and reach than in a slow time. So this is the time period when realizing that the impressions are cyclic, we can use this Kali Yuga to give us more of an impetus in order to take advantage of these opportunities. So evolution is another way, which is the third fundamental, is another way of explaining cyclic law. Because as we make these changes, we are evolving. And if we can just keep that idea of the horseshoe curve, that it's slow, but it's persistent, and it will eventually lead to a higher life. As the impressions return, we make the choices based upon our awareness of the spiritual life. The more frequently we make the higher choices, then each life will be on a higher aspect of that cycle.
Okay, here's a short reading. This happens to be from the Theosophical Movement, and it is a difficult path, age old and well trodden, dangerous yet trustworthy, precipitous yet leading to the heights. If we try to tread it for ourselves, we tumble. The sooner the better. If we try for the sake of others but lack competence, the falls may be used as awakeners and strengtheners. But try and ever keep trying is the axiom which must continuously sound in the student's heart and mind. Eventually the fogs will lift, strength will be gained, the warrior within will begin to fight for us, and we shall gain the vision splendid of an emancipated humanity. No longer servers of time and slaves of cyclic effects, but also to take our destiny in our own hands with prevision and forethought. All this is implicit in the doctrine of cycles, and we can begin humbly but quickly to learn it when our self-made destiny bids fair to overwhelm us. So really, we have great power over the cycles. We created these cycles, and we can undo them as well.
Well, that reading makes one feel, so there is a light at the tunnel. We're the light at the tunnel, and we can do it. It's that wanting to do it and wanting to keep at it.
Yes, the reading we thought was very uplifting. It was very positive because so much, especially when we think of the Kali Yuga, we think, oh man, you know, we can't do anything. It's so dark, it's depressing. But we do have those choices. We do have the chance to make a difference. And even if it's only in our little corner of the world, it will reverberate and, you know, it'll add up.
Well, the seasons itself are what really is a part of our change, because everything is constantly but the seasons give us a glimpse of our inner nature. You know, the sun becomes shorter in the fall, shorter and shorter and shorter, until finally the shortest day of the year is December 21st, the winter solstice. And then the sun becomes, the days become longer from then on until the spring. So we're affected by motion, by change. Mm-hmm. And just with the planet alone doing that, we see our festivals and our holidays, and we see it, these junctures or these events, you know, are being celebrated all through the ages this time of year. So, you know, we're immersed in this world, and we communicate with it by our feeling nature. Mm-hmm. So.
Yes, we, you know, it's all the seasons are, we think perhaps we're very fortunate to be in a climate that has four distinct seasons, because it really does make one aware of changes and the need for change within ourselves. We, you know, especially that the winter time is really for, well, it's harvest time now. So we're reaping the karma of the past year in a sense, and then we're planting seeds, which will. You know, there's a lot that goes on underground when the ground is frozen. There's still life, there's activity, but in a sense it's occult, because we don't see it. Occult strictly means hidden. So to our eyes it is hidden, but it's starting the germination process for the next cycle.
And as was stated in the comment about the seasons, and especially with the sunlight changing and all the festivals, most people we don't think are really aware of the reason behind a lot of these festivals and the decorations and all the lights. That is the one thing about this time of year, is there's just lights everywhere, people decorating their homes and decorating trees, and everything's being decorated, it seems. And it's beautiful. It's cheerful, the lights, but a lot of people don't realize that it is a time of when the sun is going to be coming back, and we're celebrating that. But a lot of people, we don't even know that they even think about what this time of the year actually means. And we're not even just talking about, you know, the birth of Jesus. There's just so much more to the festivals and the ideas at this time of year.
Yes.
Is there information relating cycles to the concept of the Tao, specifically with yin and yang?
Repeat the question. Okay, yes. Is there a relationship with the cycles and the Tao, which is the way of the you know, the yin and yang, or you know, we've all seen the symbols before. That's a good question.
It might have part
correspondences to the theosophical ideas of the absolute and spirit matter?
Could be a theosophical correspondence between the absolute and spirit matter. Spirit and matter being really two aspects of the one, that there is no separation. Yes?
Well, I'm sorry. The yin and the yang are just opposites, and they're constantly in motion. And, that the idea is because they're in constant motion, one needs to balance one's life to keep them in balance. So, it's really a basic, as manifestation came forth, it assumed the pairs of opposites, and that's what yin and yang represent, those polar opposites of each other, but the oneness in the same.
We were just going to mention that the two are actually the same side of the one, and that when we're looking at the three fundamentals, the second and third fundamental, that of cycles and evolution, are actually vehicles for the one, which is deity. So if we're thinking about cycles, which is in effect, we can look at as cycles, since it's the second fundamental, as being a vehicle for the one, then by looking at the yin and the yang as being one, then cycles can affect that as well, and we're not putting out what we really need.
Go ahead. Yeah, in the back.
Isn't that symbol, the yin and yang, solely about equilibrium and harmony and bringing peace within?
Well, we think that is, isn't the yin and the yang harmony and bringing peace within? Yeah, we think that's the main message of it is balance, that we're all going through a balancing act every day, and through our thought, word, and deed, and they all have impact. Never a harsh word is in a sense it always comes back. Same thing with kindness, but in time it will come back to us. So we are out of balance now. Our society, we're really the whole world. And it used to be that there were, although there may be some isolated tribes still that are not in the Kali Yuga, for the most part, over the last couple hundred years, just with commerce and wars and trading and intercommunication, and especially now with satellite communication, instantaneous communication, we're really all in the same age. We're all in this Kali Yuga age now, and we're all being affected by the same cycle at the same time. Yes?
Just an observation. And I lived through the 60s and the 70s as a young person. And we watch it. We try not to watch the news, but when we do watch it, we see a stark similarity between the times and the events, the turmoil, the questioning. You know, it's like it seems like that whole era has come back again. You know, and its impressions, and we just find it very amusing when we. Sometimes they show tapes of the late 60s and early 70s, and it's not much different than what's going on now. It's just that the war may be different.
Yeah.
still killing a lot of people, you know, immorally. And so people are questioning, finally, Yemen. But, you know, how many thousands of people were killed?
Well, we remember those times growing up, seeing the Vietnam War every night on the news. It was, you know, it was reported, and actually was reported in more detail than generally things are reported now. You know, it was, but for the last 100 years, really, we've been in a cycle of war and dissension and upheaval in the world. And there's also like there's a 1500-year cycle, which we didn't mention before. But 1914 was 1500 years since the murder of Hypatia, the female adept, and the closing of the schools, the great mystery schools in Alexandria, and the burning of the library, although it is said that the most important works were spirited away, you know, before the actual conflagration took place. But yeah, it's we're in a cycle of maybe it's there's still most of the wars in the past few centuries were religious wars, and that's still a factor, but it's not the only factor. So we're in a cycle of great upheaval, and we can look back to Rome, because we really do, when we talk about cycles, you know, the Rome had a Senate, and they had they were a republic, as we are, many similarities. They overextended themselves. So we can look at Rome if we want to kind of assess where we are today in the 1500-year cycle.
And we all, by looking back and seeing all the conflict that has gone on, it can become disheartening. But even though there are these grand cycles, we each have our own, so that we can make a difference. That saying, come ye out and be ye separate. Just because there's all this conflict going on doesn't mean that we can't make a difference in our lives to the people around us. And we have to keep that in mind, because when we're looking at the idea of opportunities that the cycles bring us, the fact that there is all the discord going on, we know that we can use this time in order to change ourselves, make these choices, so that we can use the cycle as an opportunity, but we also have to make sure we are doing it with the right motive.
But there's always hope, and we should never lose sight of it. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says that when righteousness declines, O Bharata, when wickedness is strong, I rise from age to age and take visible shape and move a man among men, succoring the good and thrusting the evil back and setting virtue on her high seat again. So it's, you know, it's there's cycles of light, cycles of darkness. Generally speaking, the Kali Yuga is a cycle of darkness, but there are bright spots also in the Kali Yuga. It's not all sin, suffering, and destruction and war. You know, it's the message is not going to die. I mean, it's not going to disappear. It may fall on deaf ears for the most part, but it's still there, and it's been impressed on us. It's in us. This is in our nature, and it just needs to be brought out. And when we hear it and see it, we recognize it. We have these soul memories, which may not be conscious memories, but we follow our attractions. And if we're attracted to these ideas of altruism and brotherhood and peace and harmony, that's what we strive for. That's what we really want. That's our heart's desire. Not the materialistic stuff. It's very shallow. It's very transitory. And in the end, really, you can have everything in the world, but if you've lost your soul, as it were, if you've lost your, you know, it doesn't bring peace of mind. It doesn't bring harmony. Actually, it increases the separateness, the imbalance of power and resources and whatnot. You know, where you have many people starving, and then you have many people that have great wealth, and you know, there's people with great wealth that are doing a lot of good. We're not saying they're all selfish or self-centered by any means. There's an awful lot of philanthropy that goes on as well. But there's a section in the Key to Theosophy about charity, and we have to know how to implement charitable works, because if they're not done correctly, they can actually do more harm than good. So we don't want to make people dependent upon handouts. We want people to be self-sufficient is really the way. But how do we go about it? Because it seems overwhelming.
Well, doesn't coming here and talking about these ideas send out a vibration? Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like an attempt to be heard, the truth to be heard. And even though we have sometimes smaller groups and sometimes larger, it's just the flux of life, you know. And I mean, these truths are held out here as the reason for us to join together, is to discuss them and check, test, and verify them within our own nature and see how they are a part of us. You know, we have to seem to prove it to ourselves, these ideas.
Yes.
And even though we understand them, but we got to prove it to ourselves. And we have to be so confirmed in it that it's become second nature.
And the whole, and no matter what we think, it can come back to us if it's like a negative thought. I mean, thoughts have power. And if we can, as was said, if we can populate the astral with positive thoughts, then, I mean, that certainly does the world good. If there's more and more positive thoughts that we are putting out, and negative thoughts can come back to us as well. And it's so hard to control your thoughts, because if something happens and you're automatically, like especially driving, you're automatically, you know, angry, and you know, it anger especially is very destructive.
Yes.
Detachment. You know, that's something that the Gita says that we all have to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Be detached, you know. Be the observer. You know, it's every day is an adventure, because we have to stay focused. And what do we stay focused on? Most of the time it's this ephemeral world that we live in, the body and, you know, entertainment, this, that. But you know, how often do we think, well, let's think all day about my higher nature. Like, what is that? You know, how can I access it? every day, all day long. You know, and not that we can, it's just that it's an idea that sort of attracts other ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And when you are brotherly, that comes back to us, because we are brotherly and we just do not act on it. So we are the generators,
mm-hmm,
of all things. We are gods in potential. And because we don't use our power wisely is why we are here.
Well, it's not that we don't act brotherly, but we act, but it's selectively. In general, it's selective. If we like someone, we act brotherly. If we don't like them, it's difficult. It's, you know, but that's what we need. That's the challenge, is to treat everyone like they really are a part of us, which they are. They're all aspects of us, and we've incarnated, you know, who knows how many times, but many, many times. And we've been through all experiences, and we've been through all situations, and maybe, and often we recoil from someone because they remind us of part of our darkness, our dark side. We see that reflected and we want to ignore it or get away or deny it. And so that's where the real test comes in, is being brotherly to those that we personally feel maybe some kind of animus toward, but yet we have to overlook that and try to bring out the good in them, because there is good in all. There's good in everyone.
So these are the opportunities that we have then in order to use these cycles. And we'll hear later on that in one of our upcoming classes about planting those seeds for the spring. And that's what we can do now, is use the cycle to plant those seeds in our nature, so that we can make the choices for future lives and learning those lessons and doing our duty. There's many ways that we can use the cycles when bringing back from a past life. Our duty shows itself, and we don't really have to question, is this something that came from a past life? Because it did. So we don't have to question it. It just is.
There's a very short quote: the humblest worker is seen and helped. So we have that great tribe of heroes that is always working behind the scene for the betterment of mankind. And so we try to put ourselves in the position of companions, because they're not able to directly come out at this time and in this cycle, because they would be worshipped as gods or hunted as devils. And so whatever efforts we make, you know, however humble it is, it's seen and it's helped. So we have come to the end of the hour, the end of the hourly cycle on Sunday, and we want to say, of course, we have our Wednesday evening class in the ocean, and it's class begins at 7:30, and the topic for next Sunday is the world of dreams. Meeting is adjourned.